Let's come next, brother.
Is your voice meant to be amplified in the two speakers through there?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, that'd be good.
You can say
Start from the gym.
Yeah, but Adam was always in the gym for me. Actually, we should use this one right now because you see it's more.
It manifests, just reminds you. Just as a
man. I didn't say my name before.
It's not different from Lord Chaitanya.
Introduce these ones.
Oh, you haven't seen this one.
No, I have, but after a long time. Of course, I've read this book after a long time.
No, I didn't start.
If you take this across,
it's quite good. So, we're doing continuing on. We're in the last part of the this unit, and unit 13. We've been studying the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is, as we know, the last writing of Srila Vyasadeva, who compiled all the Vedic literatures. And it contains the commentary or the essence of all the ancient Vedic knowledge is there in, you know, Srila Vyasadeva's last writing. So, and we're of the 12 cantos, we're up to canto 4 and chapter 12. And we're looking at a section of the Bhagavatam where Dhruva Maharaj goes back to Godhead. So just a little summary of what we looked at. If anyone can remember some of the details as we go along, we can put that in as well. But Dhruva Maharaj, so this is an event that happened in Satya Yuga, you know, going way back. And you know, this is happening millions of years ago.
For the same day of Brahma.
Yes, Brahma. In this day of Brahma. So Brahma, you know, in Brahma's day. Yeah, this day of Brahma, which is the first day of the second half of Brahma's life.
Yeah.
So.
Second half's the best day.
Let's hope so. What did I say? Yeah. This pastime, just to put it into a historical context, as far as possible, is taking place millions of years ago. Now, Lord Brahma, who's put in charge of creation, so he's the demigod who's put in charge of creation. he's a living entity like you or I, of course, but he is empowered to be in charge of the whole creation. You know, it's a little difficult to get a full perspective of Brahma's position. You know, he lives in the top of the part of the universe, but the universe, the whole universe itself, is connected with Brahma's actual form. So he has like a localized form, but the universe, in another sense, is not different from him. So it's just like, you know, our body. Actually, you know, if you looked at our body, there are actually millions of living entities who actually inhabit our body. For some tiny little bugs and germs, our body is like a universe, and it's that big. You know, they're so minute, and they've got their whole little families, you know, little nations and what have you. Brahma is something like that. His body is somewhat quite connected with the entire universe. So, you know, but he also has a, if he appears before us, he can appear in a form which we can, you know, perceive and talk to and what have you. So, you know, he has an unusual, you know, position. But he is a living entity like you or I who is empowered for creation. He lives for the entire duration of the universe. He's born on the first day of universal creation. He leaves, you know, at the end of his life, the universe is basically finished. He has, he lives for 100 years. Each year of Brahma's life consists of 12 months. Each month consists of 30 days and 30 nights. One day of Lord Brahma consists of 1,000 cycles to the four yugas. There is Satya Yuga, which lasts for about 2 million years.
432 times 4.
Yeah. It's
over
2 million years. Satya Yuga. 432 times 4. Yeah. And Treta Yuga is about 3/4 of that. Dwapara Yuga is about half of that, and we're in Kali Yuga now, which is about a quarter of, you know, Satya Yuga. So there's four yugas, and Brahma's one day consists of 1,000 cycles of those four yugas. At the end of Brahma's day, there is a partial creation, a dissolution of the universe, and then again, you know, then he sleeps during that devastation, and then in the morning when he wakes, there is again a recreation. So we're in the first day of the second half of Brahma's life.
Today,
that's what today is. Yeah.
This very day.
This day.
Not tomorrow.
Tomorrow's a long way. So in Brahma's life, 50 years have gone, right, of that time span we said, and in the next 50, which is present now, this is the first day of that second half. It is significant because at the end of the 50 years of Brahma, there is a complete annihilation of the universe. He can do sometimes, but he's protected by Krishna. He's a great devotee of Krishna. He sometimes has little crises, but Krishna looks after him. And Krishna, just to look after Brahma, Krishna appears once in a day of Brahma, just a little before lunch. So So each day of Brahma consists of 14 manus, and each manu exist for 71 cycles. So 14 times 71 is roughly 1,000 cycles of the yugas. So in the 28th millennium of the 7th manu, Krishna appears. So that's once in the day of Brahma. And for us, that's only 5,000 years ago. So Krishna's appearance is very rare.
In his original form.
He appears in many different incarnations and avatars. But when he comes in his original form, it is a very rare appearance.
How often does that happen?
Once in a day of Brahma.
Which is?
In the 7th manu.
Oh,
you probably...
How many hours is that?
You can hear all of this on the tape.
We're
talking.
We can sit and do it. So he appears once in his original form.
Yes.
In the day of Brahma.
Yeah.
But this set in concrete, or it can appear even just outside. It could appear twice, or if he felt like.
Oh, if he felt like.
Yeah. But I think
so it's not set in concrete. It's only.
But for him, that's how he decides.
So if he wanted to come right now, so he could just appear and...
Yeah, but, you know, when we say he appears once in the day of Brahma, when he appears at that time, he displays the complete performance of his Krishna Leela. So that means he remains for 125 years of our time, 128 years of our time, and he manifests his complete pastimes, which make up the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in that context, Krishna appears. So in other words, if Krishna manifests himself briefly to his devotees, we're not talking about that, you know, but as far as Krishna's complete leela being manifested, that is when. But so in other, you know, times and what have you, he may appear within the heart or before a devotee like that. Yeah, that's a different thing. Yeah.
So why does it say then that the Rasleela alone was like a night of Brahma? A duration?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was.
Yeah, but then it was just here for 120
years. Yeah, but you know it's Krishna. He's got his full potency, so he can do that. He can do a whole night of Brahma in 1 second if he wants to. It's just Krishna. It's not us.
But anyway, let's not get bogged down too much in the details.
Right.
So, I'm just putting this story into context when it happened. Okay? So, now, when Brahma appeared in this first day of Brahma, in the second half of his life, he manifested the first Manu, as we said. There are 14 Manus in each day of Brahma. They're in charge of various universal management. That Manu is Svayambhuva Manu. From Svayambhuva Manu, he had two sons, Uttanapada, Priyavrata, and the son of Uttanapada was Dhruva. Now, this is the story, we're talking about the story of Dhruva. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is filled with stories of Krishna, his various incarnations, avatars, and his devotees, and basically the Srimad Bhagavatam is telling us how the spirit soul revives its eternal loving relationship with the Supreme Soul. What is the nature of that loving relationship? How is that relationship revived? What are the activities once that relationship is revived? What is the consciousness of one who has revived their relationship with the Supreme Soul, that Supreme Person? This is the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, and this is actually the teachings of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Dhruva Maharaj is one such spirit soul. We are all individual spirit souls, and Dhruva Maharaj is one such spirit soul who actually fully revived his eternal relationship with the Supreme Soul. So, and that Supreme Lord, who's all the incarnations and avatars, they're all expansions of Krishna. So one of those expansions of the Lord actually appeared before Dhruva Maharaj. So Dhruva Maharaj, he was 5 years old. And he went to sit on his father's lap, who basically ruled over the earth and even extending beyond the earth. And his father had two wives, Saruchi and Suniti. Now, Saruchi was Dhruva's stepmother, who was the favourite of his father, Uttanapada. So when little boy Dhruva went to hop on the lap of his father, Saruchi said that he wasn't fit to sit on his father's lap because her son was actually, you know, eventually going to rule, and he had first preference. So she sort of insulted the little boy, you know. He was, a Kshatriya, he was born in a family of rulers. They tend to have warrior-type natures, and to be insulted like that, he took it quite harshly. And she said to him, to Ruchi, that, you know, if you want, you know, you're going to have to basically worship the Supreme Lord. She was thinking pretty much you'll have to leave your body and take birth as, you know, some great Brahmin or something, worship the Lord in order to fulfill your desire. But basically it's never going to happen. And but anyway, he took it seriously. He went and saw his mother, and his mother said, yes, you're correct. You're going to have to go to the forest and worship the Supreme Lord. There's no other way that you're going to, you know, fulfill your desires. Because Dhruva, he was so disturbed that he decided that he wanted to get a kingdom for himself greater than his father's, which was, you know, practically impossible considering, you know, his father, you know, ruled over vast parts of the universe. So he went to the forest as a 5-year-old boy, which was, you know, completely unbelievable to everyone, and he started performing the Astanga Yoga process. Now, in that Astanga Yoga process, he began to actually, what happened was Narada Muni appeared there. Narada Muni is a great devotee of the Lord, and he travels all around the universe, and the Lord inspired him to go see this boy because, you know, he's gone to worship me in the forest. He really doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to need some help. But, you know, if he's not very sincere, you might want to send him home. So, to his mother. Anyway, Narada Muni tested him out, and this boy was determined. So he said to him, you know, here are the mantras. You know, you form a deity of the Lord, just like we have, you know, little deities in the temple and what have you, that, so that when we meditate upon the Lord, we can meditate on his personal form while we perform the Astanga Yoga process. Is any yoga is actually meant to fix the mind upon, to fix the soul, its consciousness upon the Supreme Soul, who has a form. You know. So he made a little deity. I think it was out of, was it clay or mud? Yeah, it was just from the forest. And he performed the Astanga Yoga. Now, he performed it properly and, you know, to the strictest sense terms. That I think for the first month, you know, he was eating once every couple of days, and then, what's that? Every 3 days. And gradually then he would just eat leaves every so many days, and then the next month he would just take in air, and after the next month, you know, he was not even breathing in, and he was just, you know, controlling the inward and outward breaths. And his yoga practice was so powerful that the various demigods, Who was it? Indra? Asked that, could you please ask him to stop, because the potency of his yoga practice is literally shaking up the universe. You know, it's scaring. You know, it's becoming very fearful. The potency he's developing, and yeah, so there's a nice discussion on that. Why, you know, why is that? You know, that potency becomes manifest in such a powerful yogi. Anyway, what happened was that the Lord that he was meditating upon, who he'd formed the little deity upon, and he was performing his Astanga Yoga, that Lord that he was meditating upon actually then appeared before his eyes. So when he opened his eyes, he was actually there. The Lord he was meditating upon in his heart was standing right before him. And he touched Dhruva Maharaj with his conch. He had a forearm form, and that blessing enabled Dhruva Maharaj to offer some very beautiful prayers. He became filled with transcendental knowledge because of following the instructions of his guru, Narada Muni, following the process properly, and because of the blessings of the Lord. So that combination of, you know, serving the guru, the bona fide guru, and worshipping the Lord. So then, Dhruva Maharaj, the Lord offered him blessings, and he basically asked that, I don't want anything material, I just want to have pure devotional service. I just want to actually be engaged as your servant. Nonetheless, the Lord blessed him that I will give you a kingdom, even though you're not asking it. And Dhruva was actually a little bit ashamed that he'd asked the Lord for anything, or that he'd worshipped the Lord for some material result. And then he said, I don't want those material things anymore. Just if I could, you know, serve you and, you know, give you pleasure, that would be my pleasure. He said, no, I'm going to give you those things anyway, even though I know you're purified in heart. So he gave him the pole star, which is actually known as Dhruva Loka. And the pole star is situated sort of somewhat, you know, the universe actually, you know, circles around. All the planets and everything circle around the pole star. That pole star is where Dhruva Maharaj resides. And it is non-different from one of the Vaikuntha or spiritual planets which exist outside of the material creation. So then, Dhruva Maharaj, his father, he went back home. His father, you know, wanted to retire from ruling over the kingdom. He offered the kingdom to Dhruva Maharaj, and Dhruva ruled for 36,000 years. And after his rule, he was to go to, you know, back to the spiritual world. What happened was that there was a tribe, a civilization known as Yakshas, who resided in the Tibetan area. And one of them killed Dhruva's brother, Uttanapada. And his stepmother went into the forest looking for him, and she passed away as well. So then what happened was that Dhruva Maharaj, he went to this Tibetan area. We'll see you later. And he came back, and he went to the kingdom, and he had a battle with 130,000 yakshas, and killed all of those yakshas, Hare Krishna. And then after killing all those yakshas, he then went into the warriors. He wanted to go to the actual capital city. And there was a great battle where the yakshas used mystic potency to, you know, try and destroy and kill Dhruva. But, you know, he was steadfast, and he managed to... how did he defeat that? He was given a weapon? Was it... Narayan had given him a bow. So as soon as he put that Narayan weapon onto his arrow, it, you know, destroyed the illusion like that. And then Kavira went to his father, his grandfather. Kavira went to Swayambhuva Manu and said, you know, can you ask him to stop? We think he's going to wipe out the whole race. And then Swayambhuva Manu went back to Dhruva and, you know, said, you know, enough's enough. You know, I think, you know, let's not go too far with this. And, you know, he deceased. He had full control over his mind and senses. Basically, he was just letting them know, you know, don't come into my kingdom killing, you know, nice devotees and what have you, or, you know, different persons who I'm, you know, protecting on behalf of the Lord and universal management. And so, you know, Kabir offered him benedictions, and he was happy to accept a benediction that, you know, please bless me with that I can always serve the Supreme Lord. So again, he didn't ask for anything material, he just asked for that blessing always to serve the Supreme Lord. So that is a summary of, you know, where this story is coming from. Did you get that?
Yeah.
And especially for your friend, she's coming back in a little while.
Yeah,
and she needed to hit so high. She said she had to pop out for about an hour, but I just want to make sure she's got the context of where their conversation. Hey, Krishna. So, and of course, you know, Michael, you felt probably good for you to hear the context of that as well. So, in the meantime, my bags arrived. So, we had some discussions last week. Where do we leave off? Who can remember where we left off with our discussion last week? We were talking about that, the blessings of the demigod. Because there's a...
just after Kubera's... just after Kubera's blessings. Just after that.
Right. So we stopped. Yeah, and we had a bit of a conversation about Nimala
Agata
Sukriti. That's right. It's because Nimala and Shweta brought up the question. They were saying that they were taught in Bhakti Shastri that where it mentions in the Bhagavad Gita that four types of pious persons approach Krishna, they were saying that they were taught that by pious activities, you know, lead to bhakti or surrender to Krishna. And I was saying, well, that's not correct. You know, that the various different types of... So we discussed about three different types of pious activity.
Yes.
But no pious activities create bhakti. They're favourable. You know, they're sort of... They can lead you in the right direction, but they never end. They never result in bhakti at any stage. You know, they can sort of just get you to the right place. But that was interesting because they were saying that in their bhakti shastri that they were going, that they were told something different. You know, that actually, you know, these four types of persons, because they're pious, that they actually it results in devotional service.
So, isn't that only for the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah. Not your Bhakti Shastri. No, it wasn't yours. It was someone else's class.
I'm just trying to understand about
it. It was, who did they say?
Is it related
to the material
places? What's that? Is it related to the material piety?
What does
it piety mean?
Yeah, that's what they were thinking. That, you know, if someone is a pious person, that basically that leads to the point where they'll surrender to Krishna.
Only a later reference there is if somebody is pious, then they may not they may attract a devotee.
Yes.
If a devotee comes, they may not send away.
Yeah.
In that sense, it is a favorable condition to...
That's right. What I was saying.
Yeah.
It's and therefore the question is, where does bhakti come from?
Yeah.
You know, you associate with a devotee,
yeah.
And a devotee may engage you in devotional service. There's some agyata sukriti, and that's devotional service which you may or may not even know that you're performing.
Yeah.
Gradually, it's called agyata sukriti. It can accumulate to the point where the first, you know, dawning of faith or shraddha, which is the very beginning point of devotional service, sort of, you know, begins. So, you know, therefore we see that, you know, brahmanas. In the Bhagavad Gita, it actually says, you know, only by devotional service am I to be understood. You can't understand Krishna or devotional service, or practically even the devotees, by pious activities. You can understand those things only through devotional service. you know, that's un- so. Srila Prabhupada mentions in his discussions in the second chapter of the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, text number 19, he mentions that, you know, he gives the example of that Brahmanas, they're very, very pious. They're performing all the brahminical activities perfectly, so they're practically more pious than anyone. But still, it doesn't mean that they can understand anything about devotional service or Bhagavan or bhakti. And he gives the example that when Krishna asked the cowherd boys that you go and ask the brahmanas to give some food because me and Balaram are hungry, they considered that it was an inappropriate time in the jagya, and therefore they couldn't distribute the prasad. The Prabhupada mentions, but the very person they're supposed to be worshipping is asking for the prasad now. He's asking for the food now. And so they're worshipping, you know, God, who they have no understanding, because he's just come and said, give it to me now. And they say, no, you cannot have it. This is for someone else. We're worshipping God. You know, so God's come and said, we want the prasad now. No. So really there's no understanding of God, or, you know, the rituals are going on, but, you know, the understanding is not there, because they're not. Whereas Arjun was a Kshatriya, and when Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to him, Krishna says, I am speaking to you because you're my devotee. And because you're my devotee, you will understand. And therefore, Arjun said, Padam Brahma, Padam Dhamma, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. See? So, it's not a question of being pious. It's a question of having devotion, you know, that you can understand the Lord. And that devotion is transferred from a devotee, the heart of a devotee, to an aspiring person like that. It doesn't come from pious activity.
Yes, and so in the 11th canto of
that's right, piety accrued from bhakti, whether it be knowingly or unknowingly performed, Well, you can go to the Goloka Vrindavan from anywhere in the universe as long as you're a devotee of the Lord. If you associate with devotees, especially in the Braja mood, then you can go to the Goloka Vrindavan from the heavenly planets, from the hellish planets, from the earthly planets, as long as you're taking shelter, taking guidance from the Brajabasi line of devotees, then you can go back to Godhead from anywhere. But if you don't take shelter of the Brajabasi devotees, then you cannot. Even devotees of the Lord, if they don't take shelter of the Brajabasi devotees, they can go to Vaikuntha, Narayan's planet, but they can't go to Goloka Vrindavan. They must take shelter of the Brajabasi devotees.
And I guess it's dangerous in heavenly planets, you can just be enjoying too much, don't you?
Yeah, it's so. You know, many of the demigods who may have a desire to advance quickly in devotional service may desire to take birth in the earthly planets, because it's, you know, especially during this period of Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement, because it's just the best atmosphere, you know, not too much heavenly enjoyment, not too much, you know, extreme suffering, and just, you know, nice association with devotees in the Lord Chaitanya's movement and the Prajabasi mood. So, you know, that therefore they'll descend and take birth as children of the here in Melbourne of the, you know, of the Hare Krishna movement. But some of them, you know, some of them may appear in all sorts of different places. You know, some of them appear in, you know, families of persons who may not be, you know, devotees or you know, it's for different reasons. You know, Krishna places his devotees in, you know, we see the Prahlad Maharaj took birth in the family of demons. It's not that, you know, so devotees, you know, generally they will take birth in the family of devotees, and you know, which is conducive, but sometimes for different pastimes, the Lord's different preaching purposes, devotees may actually take birth in a variety of different places.
Right. And I guess sometimes, like, some born into the movement, they want to go out and experience, and then others that have already experienced become
more fit.
So
yes. Yes, the Gauda Sakriti means that somehow or another you've been engaged in devotional service, in the Lord's service. And the Lord has accepted it.
So basically, just being pious as usual, I mean,
that's lame. No, it is. But it's not, it's favourable. So, you know, and, you know, it sort of brings up the nature of our Krishna consciousness. On this subject too, the nature of our Krishna consciousness movement, that, for instance, the way to become, you know, all the scriptures tell one to become pious. That means, you know, do things like practice brahmacharya, give in charity, perform different austerities, study the scriptures. What are some of the other things, you know, for developing, accruing piety, you know, being truthful, moral, controlling the mind and senses,
giving
in charity. All of these things, if one performs them, one gradually becomes pious and the main benefit of that, those activities, is that one becomes free from the modes of passion and ignorance, right? Which means that one becomes free from lethargy or inactivity. One is incapable of really doing anything, you know. And if one does something, it's, you know, really foolish. You know, the mode of passion, then, you know, one has lusty desires and very greedy, like that. So, and if they're not fulfilled, one becomes angry and sinks back into the mode of ignorance. When a person becomes pious and good, they negate the influence of the modes of passion and ignorance in their existence. So that's what piety means. They elevate themselves to the mode of goodness, predominantly. Now, our process is that if you just hear the Srimad Bhagavatam, such as we're doing, and the holy name of the Lord, and serve the devotees, then you take the elevator. Instead of taking each step as you would, that, you know, I'll practice celibacy for 10 years and give it to you. You're taking each little step along the way. In our process, you can hear and serve a devotee and practically immediately become elevated to that same position where the modes of passion and ignorance are not actually affecting you. So one becomes firmly situated in the mode of goodness at that. So that piety, which may be accrued over many lifetimes, can be achieved by a devotee by the grace of the Lord, by the grace of Krishna, just by hearing and chanting and serving the devotee. So this is our process. Therefore, you see in this chapter, it describes that just by hearing this pastime of Dhruva Maharaj, one accumulates massive amounts of piety, one becomes pious. Like that. But that's piety of the nature of bhakti. But that piety of the nature of bhakti automatically has all the benefits of the piety that you may accumulate through material means as well. So, this is our process. It's very powerful. So Prabhupada gives analogies. One analogy he gives is that if you're in the fog, so you're comparing the material world to be something like the fog, and you have to take so many precautions to move very slowly and make sure you don't fall in some pitfall. You know, so you're moving, you're looking very carefully, you may have special lights and, you know, so many different difficulties you undergo to make sure you don't get into some danger. So performing pious activities is like that. You're just being very careful as you go through the material world, restraining yourself in different ways, putting all sorts of things into place so that you don't fall into the modes of passion and ignorance like that. But Prabhupada says, but if the sun comes out, you can move freely. So for us, the sun coming out means you just come in the presence of Krishna. So, we hear and chant and serve the devotees and the Son of Krishna appears and we can move freely, you know, which is so much easier than all the precautions you've got to make getting around in the fog when the sun's not there. Okay? So they're the persons who are practicing, separately, brahmacharya and charity, this, that and the other, like that. They're just making sense. Another example he gives, if I can remember what it was. What was it? He gave another very nice example. Anyway, you know, so we were discussing Hare Krishna. Now, we just left off our discussion. We just finished off a little bit of the conversation from where we left off. We're talking about piety and what have you. So you might want to catch that up on the tape. But alright, so let's move forward now. That's sort of where we left off. Any comments on that? Any more questions on that? Just quickly.
So piety doesn't become material piety.
Yes.
Bring you to the mode of goodness, but still, in order to transcend that, you have to come into association of devotees.
You do. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then you can clear a gap of prithvi, which will elevate you.
Yeah. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, it describes that. We'll get that. Get that verse.
Do you do your playing? No, they haven't done.
You know, when we say that the motive, when we say that, you know, this piety is favourable, it's because, you know, you can't, it's not possible to serve the Lord while you're situated in the modes of passion and ignorance. Because devotion of service means that you know, you actively use your senses to serve the Lord. People in the mode of ignorance, one, they're inactive. You know, they're, so for instance, there's no question of getting out of bed to go to Mongolia. You know, it requires activity. Someone in the mode of ignorance, you just couldn't even get them out of bed. So they're inactive. You know, you may not be able to get them to do any work. And then, if the mode of passion is there, you know, bhakti means that you utilize something and your own body and senses for the satisfaction of the Lord's desires. Whereas a person in the mode of passion, they can only utilize everything for their own personal desires. They can only, you know, they won't give up their, you know, whatever they see, they think, you know, because they're greedy, they're thinking this should be mine. So if there's an offering, if someone's offering some food, they'll be looking at that plate thinking, you know, I want that, you know, that's for me, that's for my belly, you know, like that. You know, seeing living entities according to their lusty desires, you know, the women are meant for my enjoyment, this man is my competitor, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm demonstrating my prowess as a great person. Whatever. You know, the modes of passion and ignorance means that, you know, it's all centered, their activities and their thoughts and everything is centered around their own bodily pleasure. And therefore, you know, you can't be thinking the food in that bowl is mine, and at the same time thinking the food in that bowl is Krishna's. You know, it's one or the other. Like that. So, you know, one actually has to come to the point where one is free from these lust and greed and you know, ignorance and foolishness and inactivity in order to serve the Lord. And there has to be some concept also that I'm not this body. Persons in the mode of ignorance and passion think I am this body. You actually have to understand, no, I'm not this body. I'm a spirit soul. And I, therefore, I should be performing spiritual activities, you know, for the Supreme Lord. Now, these understandings are there for those in the above the bodily concept, which means in the mode of goodness. In that mode of goodness, one may perceive, yes, I am a spirit soul, not this body, and I should serve this, you know, God. It's an in-between, you know, from when they come to that level, they can actually come to the Brahman platform, Brahman, you know, Brahminical platform. Therefore, Prabhupada says, don't think that Arjuna was a Kshatriya, just a Kshatriya, he was also Brahmana. Because in that same example we discussed before, that, you know, when Krishna explained to him that, you know, I am Paramahansa, he said, yes, I accept that, I understand that. So he's a Brahmana. One has to be a Brahmana, Prabhupada says that several times in his book, one has to be a Brahmana in order to, you cannot be a devotee without first becoming a Brahmana. So therefore, he gives the example of Arjuna. Arjuna is a Brahmana. Why? Because he understood Brahman. Externally, yes, he acted as a Kshatriya, but he had the qualifications of a Brahmana. Whereas those Brahmanas in the Jagya, they couldn't properly understand Brahman. God had actually come. So when one comes to the mode of goodness, which is material, the next step is one gets to the in-between position where one can, come to the level of Brahman. There's some Brahman realization. One may understand that I must serve God, but one's conception of God and what is devotional service and the relationship between the soul and the Supreme Lord is not complete. It can be impersonal, so it's an in-between. If they actually, from that point, then take up devotional service, then the nature of the Supreme Lord, bhakti or service to him, and the bhakta become manifest at that. So piety or coming to, the mode of goodness is favourable because it gets you to that in-between position. But in that in-between position, the in-between position means that you're not obstructed from serving the Lord because you're so controlled by passion and ignorance. The in-between position means you have some concept that you're not this body and a soul, and some concept that you serve God. So all of these things are favourable. If you then associate with a devotee who, engages you in devotional service, trains you in devotional service, gives you faith in devotional service, then the transcendental realizations begin. But see, at that in-between point, many persons think that, I should serve God. Ganesh is God. Or everyone is God. Here's the new fellow on the street corner, he is God. So you really need a devotee to direct you first to God. Now, here's Bhagavad Gita, here is God. Here is Krishna, Srimad Bhagavatam, here is God. Here is Narayan, Vishnu, Rama. Okay, you're in the in-between position, but, you still can't quite perceive the nature of the Supreme Lord, nor how to serve him, nor who is his devotee. So you really need the devotee at that stage to then say, okay, everything is favourable there. The impediments of the lower modes are not there. You've got some hazy understanding that you should be doing something. What that is, now the devotee can actually engage you. If the devotee is not there at that stage, you're really nowhere.
That's like the Mayavadis and those kind of...
Yeah, and Brahmanas in general, and many pious persons.
That's actually, sometimes there can be more ages, isn't it? Mayavadis.
Well, especially when they're teaching, and they've really got no idea what they're doing.
You can still call that goodness, but still it's not...
Yeah, there's some degree of goodness, but still they will fall back down within the clutches of the modes of nature and the control of material energy by not getting that proper shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord through the mercy of the devotees. Yes. Yeah, and an example that Prabhupada gives in that, right, is that, which comes from the scriptures, is that if a snake is approaching you and you see that that snake has a beautiful jewel on its head, you see, then you think, oh, there's a beautiful snake. But actually, it's just a snake. And it will still bite you and it's still dangerous. So, the good qualities of a non-devotee are like that jewel. They're just still the snake.
That's more like the mode of goodness.
There was in one place, it was Shankaracharya's, when Shankaracharya was there,
yes.
It was a place where the snake gave protection.
Shringer.
gave protection. So that means even a snake, and we have it using that a snake, how it became a devotee. So by the qualities that we are saying, that not the snake is sick. Jewel is just a part, that's not a quality, but if you see a snake giving protection, like Shankaracharya saw, that's a different, that's a quality.
That is so, a good quality, yes.
So then you can take it that that snake is developed. Just think in that way.
Yes, so we want to see good qualities.
Yeah, but we're saying that you get the example that having a jewel is a quality. That is an external feature. That's, am I trying to make sense?
Yeah, you're making sense. If a snake has good qualities, then we're no, but if a snake has good qualities, he can come and sit in our back of his own class, you know, feed him milk and bananas. But no, they have good qualities. What do we accept? But generally, snakes don't have good qualities, you know. If they have good qualities, then, you know, what, we accept them. You got a few mates at home.
My mother is terrified of snakes, as a divine. They're very friendly.
A snake charmer, you always become a snake from the environment.
What's that?
A snake charmer. Normally, death is only by the snakes. At one stage or another.
No.
Really? One snake or something. He may control so many snakes.
They're usually pretty good.
Oh, my mind.
Yeah,
but do you know a Jewish Prabhu had said in Malampas, an example of it was Prabhupada. He's been bit by every possible snake in Australia many times. But what, when they killed him?
The
funnel backfired.
Because snakes
were not
there, so it came back in the next birth.
Okay.
So is that what it is, like, if you even when we had a thousand, when you do the mother of goodness and love, is that what you meant? The mother of goodness and love, but
the
in-between
position. All right. Let's have a look at text 14. So we heard, you know what got us onto that conversation, the mode of goodness, was, yeah, but in the last class, someone said that when they go to India, if they can't go to a devotee temple, they eat prasad at the demigods' temples. That's what started that whole conversation. And therefore, we had the discussion on the difference between the mode of goodness and, you know, devotional service, and then that led us on to the fact that, but it says in the Gita that, the, you know, people who are pious go to God, so somehow if we eat demigod prasad and become pious and we surrender to Krishna. That was, there was some inference, you know, some connection. Right? So we, but because it's related to here to, you know, Dhruva Maharaj accepted benedictions from the demigods, but there is some, you know, qualification that devotees can accept things which are favourable for the devotional service, but we're not, you know, approaching demigods to become pious that will lead to being a devotee. That was really where that whole thing started. Okay. The self-controlled great soul Dhruva Maharaj thus passed many years favourably executing three kinds of worldly activities, namely religiosity, economic development and satisfaction of all material desires. Thereafter, he handed over the charge of the royal throne to his son. So, Prabhupada mentions in this purport, because, you know, these activities appear to be quite materialistic, he mentions that is the way of behaviour of great devotees. Srila Raghunath Das Goswami, one of the direct disciples of Lord Chaitanya, was the son of a very rich man. Although he had no interest in enjoying material happiness, when he was entrusted with doing something in managing the state, he did it perfectly. Srila Gaurasundara, Lord Chaitanya, advised him, from within, keep yourself and your mind completely aloof, but externally execute the material duties just as they need to be done. A very, very nice instruction. This transcendental position could be achieved by devotees only, as described in the Bhagavad Gita, while others, such as yogis, try to control their senses by force. Devotees, even though possessing full sensory powers, do not use them because they engage in higher transcendental activities. So, here is a nice point for preaching, especially within, you know, a comparison of various yoga methods. That most yogis, people who practice yoga, if they're practicing properly, they're trying to forcefully control the mind and senses to make them weaker. They're trying to forcefully control, subdue the strength and sensual strength of the senses. Yes, but a devotee has no need to do that. And they can actually, a devotee can even engage fully in activities as described here that keeping yourself and your mind completely aloof, but externally execute the material duties as they need to be done. So a devotee can engage their senses in all sorts of material duties, but they're not fearful that their senses will become ensnared or cause them some difficulty, become uncontrolled or be engaged in the modes of passion and ignorance. That even though they're performing various material duties, ruling a kingdom, ruling a family, so many different things, fighting as a soldier or what have you, still, if they become a devotee, they can keep themselves aloof from those activities, even though doing those activities perfectly, from the material perspective. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a really good, example of this, because he was like a high court judge. So, daily, you'd imagine that, to be absorbed for some hours each day in the mundane affairs, this one has stolen my money, this one has killed him, this one has, committed adultery. You're just hearing just constantly. There's no Krishna Lila amongst that. But he actually did his service so perfectly that everyone admired him. The English, the Indian people, and even the people who were getting the sentences, even the people that he was doing judgment for, everyone respect. Yes, that is, that is it. Yeah, very fair, wonderful. So he just did it so perfectly. The English people would, take some hours to do each case, write up their notes, and they would get a few cases done each day. He would do something like 15, 20 minutes or, very quickly, hear the whole case. He'd have written up his notes in that time and given a perfect judgment. And, he was just, that no one would criticize. Just very, very expert. But you know, he's although he's doing his material activities, material duties perfectly, he's still a yogi whose senses are in no way affected by all that material interaction. You know, that is the potency of devotional service. So, you know, this is, but a yogi can't do that. They actually have to.
Excuse me, yogis?
Yes. A yogi can't do that. You know, people who want to practice yoga, they have to try and hide, you know, find some secluded place and avoid association with the opposite sex, and, you know, do so many things to, you know, make sure their senses don't again become like that.
Become
any comments on that?
Become a bit artificial.
What's that?
Sometimes yogi practices can lead to artificial control. Not sure
they can. They can. That's right. Yes, it's out of control. Yeah. But devotional service gives one that ability to, you know, the senses are controlled. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Even in the even senior devotees should always act on the side of caution. Yeah, to show us, you know. Narada Muni says that in the Narada Bhakti Sutra that. And Bhaktivinoda Thakura writes that in his books as well, that, you know, a devotee is not, you know, there are no real rules and regulations that they particularly need to follow, because so here, like Dhruva Maharaj, he's a great yogi, and yet he's not following any rules of restricting himself from any of the various sensual or material activities of ruling a kingdom. He's just fully engaged. You know, there's no restrictions for him. So, a devotee who, you know, we're talking about devotees who are, you know, perfect devotees. You know, they're actually situated on the transcendental platform of devotional service. You know, constantly, fixed up. They don't necessarily have to follow the various rules and regulations of the scriptures as others do. But for the sake of caution, Narada Muni says that they should. And also for the sake of guiding others who may follow them, imitate them, they should. As you know, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita himself, there's nothing in the world that, you know, I don't want any, I have no desire to fulfill, I'm not in want of anything, you know, but I'm engaged in prescribed duties. If I did not follow prescribed duties, all the world would be put into ruination, you know. People, so he's God. He doesn't have to follow any rules and regulations, but he does, because he knows that people are going to follow. So, for the sake of caution, and, you know, one should also not overestimate one's position as a devotee, think that one is more advanced than one is, and one should not underestimate the potency of Maya, especially the influence of material energy in this Kali Yuga.
So, when you're saying advanced devotee is a person above the bhava stage, devotee in the prema stage?
Well, devotee, you know, the devotee should have you know, ruchi, shakti, you know, at least, you know, they should not only be nishta, fixed up, but they should have a very, very powerful taste and eagerness for devotional service, ruchi, and you know, they should be, you know, a shakti means that they are, you know, completely attached to the transcendental platform and completely detached from the material platform. The difference between ruchi and shakti is this, that...
Because the example of Jadavara tells us that even the Baba stage one can...
Yes, that's right.
So you have to be careful.
Yeah, that's right.
He was such a powerful king. He had all the wealth and beautiful. He left everything to go to the forest.
Yeah.
And he was doing it, but then he got attracted to the deer.
Yes.
So it tells us that even in the Baba stage, when you say that bhakti, you don't have... A devotee doesn't do it, but they hear this in...
But for the sake of preaching, you know, sometimes devotees have to you know, not strictly adhere to some formalities and rules and regulations, otherwise they're not going to be able to preach. And they may not be on the Bhava platform. You know, they may get a taste of Bhava every now and then. But, you know, for the sake of preaching, sometimes devotees may have to... so, for instance, you know, generally, devotees should always get up and go to Mangaladi. And not think, oh, I'm on the Bhava platform now, just spontaneous, you know. But, you know... If a devotee, sometimes they're up preaching late in the evening and then into the night, and then the next day they've got a big day of preaching, they may have to sleep in. You know, even till after sunrise. You know, some of the rules and regulations, sometimes for the sake of preaching, have to be, you know, adjusted. And they're not Bhava Bhaktis necessarily, but you know, if there is something for preaching or you know their service, sometimes a devotee may transgress the various rules and regulations. But for their own personal pleasure or sense gratification, or you know, but if there's no you know purpose. Particularly for the Lord's pleasure or for, you know, serving the Guru or what have that, they should then err on the side of cautiousness. You know. Which is the case with, you know, Bharat Maharaj. The difference generally between Ruchi and Shakti is this, that, you know, on the Ruchi platform, they both have a great taste, and by and large they're detached from material things and attached to spiritual life. On the platform of Ruchi, a devotee is slightly more attached to perfecting his devotional service, whereas they come to a Shakti, the attachment swings more to the Lord himself. And on the platform of Ruchi, a devotee, you know, sometimes if the mind just partially, just momentarily, may wander off into Maya, thinking of material things or what have you, the devotee may not notice, you know, that point at which it happened, and you know, they quickly drag their mind back to the spiritual. On the platform of a Shakti, they're extremely aware of that point where, you know, Maya, material taint of the slightest degree enters, you know, at that. And of course, on the platform of Bhava, generally that material traces don't enter at all. One is, you know, spontaneously, powerfully moved by the spiritual energy. But still on that platform above it, it is possible to, fall down if there are some serious transgressions. So it's a nice example here. Now, Dhruva Maharaj, he had these realizations, this cosmic manifestation bewilders living entities like a dream or phantasmagoria, because it is a creation of the illusory external energy of the Lord. So, Prabhupada gives this example in one of his lectures that Maya is called Gunamayi because it consists of the gunas. So you can call something golden, he gives this example. You can call something golden because it's made of gold. So we call this material energy, as here, as Dhruva is saying, it's made from the three modes of material nature. It's made from this illusory substance. Of course it's going to bewilder people. It's literally made from the three modes of material nature, three qualities of illusion. But you can also call something golden because it's gold covered, which is another quality of gunamaya, that it covers. Now, Dhruva at the end left his kingdom, which extended all over the earth and was bounded by the great oceans. He considered his body, his wives, his children, his friends, his army, his rich treasury, his very comfortable palaces, his many enjoyable pleasure grounds to be creations of the illusory energy. Thus, in due course of time, he retired to the forest in the Himalayas known as Bhadarik Ashram. What is Bhadarik Ashram famous for? Nadanarayan Rishi. Who else is there? Is that the Asadeva? No, he went to Ganga Sagar. What's that? Uddhava. He went there for some time. Very important instruction from this, that in the beginning, because Dhruva Maharaj literally approached the Lord for some illusory material things, and eventually he realized that everything is part of the illusory creation. Prabhupada says that we can learn from the acts of Dhruva that somehow or another, if one becomes Krishna conscious, it does not matter what his motivation is in the beginning. He will eventually realize the real truth by the grace of the Lord. Important point there, because, people come to the Krishna consciousness movement, we all come with some. We have various motivations other than pure devotional service, but we shouldn't bar a person or, say, "Well, you're not a good candidate." That somehow or another, if they can become Krishna conscious, then whatever their motivation was in the beginning becomes irrelevant. But, you know, people are given some chance, you know. Now, in Bhadarika's realm, Dhruva Maharaj's senses become completely purified because he bathed regularly in the crystal clear purified water. He fixed his sitting position by the yogic practice, controlled the breathing processes in the air of life. In this way, his senses were completely withdrawn. Then he concentrated his mind on the Archavigraha form of the Lord, which is the exact replica of the Lord, and thus meditating upon him entered into complete trance. Because of his transcendental bliss, incessant tears flowed from his eyes, his heart melted, and there was shivering and standing of the hairs all over his body. Thus transformed in a trance of devotional service, Dhruva Maharaj completely forgot his bodily existence, and thus he immediately became liberated from material bondage. So he is described as a Mahabhagavat devotee, you know, first class pure devotee. These symptoms that we hear here are described in, you know, first class devotees, ultima adhikaris. These symptoms are not to be imitated, but when one is actually advanced, these symptoms are exhibited. At that time, it is understood that the devotee is materially free. Of course, from the very beginning of devotional service, the path of liberation immediately opens. Just as the coconut taken from the tree immediately begins to dry, it simply takes some time for the shell and pulp to separate from one another. When one is liberated, even from the subtle body, at that time the living entity is competent and fully prepared to be transferred to the transcendental or spiritual world. The description of the bodily symptoms of Dhruva makes it apparent that he became perfectly fit to be transferred to the spiritual world. One can experience the distinction between the subtle and gross bodies even daily. In a dream, one's gross body is lying on the bed, while the subtle body carries the soul, the living entity, to another atmosphere. But because the gross body has to be continued, the subtle body comes back and settles in the present gross body. Therefore, one has to become free from the subtle body. This freedom is known as Muktalinga. The nice description there, what happens when you're dreaming. The subtle body carries the soul to another place. So I guess it's something like, you know, when you're driving a car, you know, in the old days, you're going to the shops, you drive up to the shop, you'd leave your car going, you'd run to the shop, buy your milk and jump back in the car. So the driver can actually, you know, leave the car running, you know, as long as there's enough fuel, you know, energy in the car. So, you know, the subtle body appears, you know, seems to take the soul, as Prabhupada says here, and leave the body. But the body must be an idol. It's got sort of enough power, you know, to just keep motoring on until the soul comes back. When you're dreaming, yeah.
So they say the car is on, the driver is on.
Yeah, so, you know, there's enough energy, you know.
Then the Paramatma is still there? Because
the Paramatma is there, the body. That means the body,
that's what gives life to the body.
Yes.
Maybe when the soul is going, the Paramatma is still there.
Well, I think the Paramatma is, it's a good question. Any views on that? Paramatma is it? Yeah, well, there you go. That's a good point. Any comments on that one? That there's one Paramatma there? What's that? There's only one Paramatma. That's described in the Bhagavad Gita.
Actually, there's only one Paramatma, but it's got a feature that can be in two places at once.
Yes. Always witness. Yes. Yeah, very good. Good use of the Bhagavad Gita. That the Paramatma is always overseeing. So that's, you know, described in there.
So it has to be with the soul.
Always, yeah, must be. Always overseeing and witnessing and sanctioning. So even in the subtle body, the soul needs the sanction of the Paramatma, who has to witness, you know. So it's the same, whether you're in the why would the, you know, the Paramatma's interest is the soul, not the body. So much.
Now this stage is,
are
we talking of someone dreaming or someone who's clinically dead?
That's someone dreaming. They're just dreaming. No, well, that's what we're saying. Evidently, Prabhupada says here, and I've heard him say this in lectures as well, and devotees have asked him, so the soul leaves the body? And he says, yes. You know, so, I mean, it's saying here, in a dream, one's gross body is lying on the bed while the subtle body carries the soul, the living entity, to another atmosphere.
Because it's still connected. Although it's left the body, it's always still connected. Now, is it in thread that always connects it to the body, unless you...
What is that thin thread? What is that thin thread? Is it silk, cotton?
Some people call it the primordial thread or something like that.
Who are those some people? We need some Shastric references. Yeah.
Everything.
We need Shastric reference for it. We need a reference. Otherwise, what's that? But he's saying here it does.
The perception is open up, and then you get certain things that you would otherwise not perceive when you are under the influence of your mind and
Well, he's saying the subtle body carries the soul, the living entity, to another atmosphere. So, for instance, any comments on this? Yeah, I mean, you know, I've heard various lectures Prabhupada discussing this point and listened very carefully to what he's saying, and my definite impression is that the soul in the subtle body can actually leave the body. You know, that's my distinct impression of just pretty much clearly what he's saying.
But what I have heard is that this is not possible for just ordinary people to do that. It's for great acharyas.
Oh, this is just ordinary dream he's talking about. Here he's just saying you're dreaming.
It depends on
ordinary dream.
Yeah, but depends on what kind of dream.
Ordinary person, ordinary dream.
Yeah, but depends on what dream.
Yeah.
I discussed this with Bhanu Sama in the last thing, the last he gave the class at Melbourne Uni after he was spoken for 20 minutes. But I'll ask him specifically where he references.
Yeah.
He's discuss it.
Yeah. Any other comments, please? So, you know, who understands from this statement that the soul carried in the subtle body, leaves the body and comes back?
So, one thing I was also tested before, and the OB, the outer body experience.
Yes.
And sometimes the patient is lying on the
bed. Yes.
The subtle body.
The soul is hovering. Yeah, the subtle body is above,
yeah.
Looking down.
Yeah.
And the soul, as Prabhupada is saying, is in the subtle body, not in the body lying down. The body is there. Still has the symptoms of in a coma or something.
But my mind is they're still actually connected when they're at 20, but you have this outer body connection, you've still got a connection. And so if you imagine it just like a little spider's web line like this, it's very fine because you're only 1/10,000th ahead of a hair in fact. But that, so is that mind connection.
I need some shastra about what is that line? It's silk, cotton?
Well, no, it's the same quality as the actual spirit soul itself. It's not different.
Identification.
False ego.
Is it?
No,
that's the only connection usually between the soul and...
False ego.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like,
that's probably similar to what Mike was talking about. You know, I think sometimes when something is extremely difficult to understand, then, you know, it appears that they're presenting some material, way to reconcile this factor. But, you know, I've not seen anywhere in Prabhupada's lectures or scriptures or any of the charge books where it mentions anything about, you know, a thread other than, as you were saying, the false ego, the ahankara.
Yeah.
It's not difficult to understand that the soul can, empower, when the soul is in the body has energy. The soul is giving the heart energy, the heart is pumping the blood, the machine is running. If there is enough charge and energy, the soul can step out of the body and come back in. While that, if the soul, of course, does not come back in, and that energy, then is depleted before the soul comes back in, then there can be death. But if there is enough, similarly, if you leave a car running, you pop into the shop, but there's not enough petrol in the car, or the what have you, or your battery was, flat or what have you, and the alternator's dead, then, you can come back and your car's not going. But, it's not difficult to understand how a machine can have enough charge in it to keep going while the, person steps away from it and then comes back and recharges it, keeps it going. But there doesn't necessarily, when you go into a shop and leave a car running, you don't have to connect some electric cord or wire and attach it to the car and, have that lead go in with you to the shop.
Yeah, that's
Is it
but the fact is that's how it is. By practical experience, we have practical experience is what I've discussed with
them. Oh, that'll be good. It'd be interesting to hear, some reference. It'd be nice.
So
could
it be
just
like that, so long as the Paramatma is with the soul,
yes,
the soul can enter back into that body. But once the Paramatma is separating off, because the description there is in Bhagavad-gita, just when the soul enters, the eyes don't open. The Paramatma has to be there. only then there's actual life. So without the, when the Paramatman leaves the soul, then the soul cannot enter into the body anymore. So the person is dead.
Does the Paramatma ever leave the soul in his at any
body,
moment during
out
his
of the
whole?
Out of the body?
No, it appears, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita, the reference is that the Paramatma is always the sanctioner and the witness.
Even when the person is dead?
Yes. Because, yeah, so. There, you know, there's no references that you know, Paramatma goes on a little holiday. And, you know, the jiva gets himself in a bit of a mess while Paramatma's, you know, sunbaking in Acapulco. You know, he's always there, always there.
I also have the impression that he's always there from the material.
That quote from the Bhagavad Gita, part of what you're saying is that if the super soul who always accompanies the soul, if he doesn't give sanction to go into, back into that body, then he cannot. So if the soul, you know, for instance, say that the soul leaves the body, you know, there are instances, right, of yogis who go into meditation. Have you heard of this, where some people practice yoga? Have you ever heard of this, they have found someone sitting in like a lotus position in their flat, dead.
Yeah,
you know, they've gone into meditation. The soul may have left the body, and they literally died in that yogic trance. That the super soul has not sanctioned them going back in that body. So that's possible. No, not dying at will. They accidentally die. They just meant to be practicing yoga, and they just accidentally went into. Yes. The soul just doesn't come back into the body. Yeah. So if the soul doesn't sanction, the soul can sanction. You know, the super soul can sanction the soul being carried, you know, for the purpose of some dream, but it also sanctions the soul going back. If the super soul does not sanction the soul going back, then it can result in death.
Is it the same? Generally, it forces you to come back in those circumstances, but if it's time to go, then it will later to go.
Mm. That's right. That's right. There is a discussion, nice discussion Prabhupada gives, that when you do a heart transplant, the soul actually has to transfer from one heart to the other, doesn't it? Which it does. If the super soul sanctions it, the soul will inhabit the new heart. You know, which is proof that the soul can move out of the heart. Same person, different heart. It is actually same person. Same person. You know, he wakes up the same individual. That soul has now left the heart and literally inhabit a new heart. And that proves that the soul can't leave the heart.
Not all are not successful, but
and I have heard that in the discussion with Prabhupada, and that's what happens. So. Yeah, different things that come up during the day, sometimes even from previous lifetimes, and they sort of swirl around and mix up and come up as dreams. I was having a dream last night. It reminds me of a dream last night. I was hearing different lectures on some of what we were talking about at the start of our class, how devotees rise above the motive, pass from ignorance and come to goodness and then come to the transcendental plane, and you know, it's a very fascinating subject. And last night I was dreaming. All night long I was just going over, you know, I was, Prabhupada said this, like that. And I woke up and I got in the car and I just heard those same messages. So like for you know, 2 days and at night as well, my mind's just been, so what you think about during the day, you know, so Prabhupada gives the example, if during the day you see some gold and you see a mountain, at night you might dream of a golden mountain. You know, it can get, so things get thrown together a little bit. You can't make too much sense of it. But, you know, a devotee's life has a lot more purpose and meaning to it, which means that you may derive more, you know, substance from some of the devotees' dreams than what you may make from others. But, you know, you can get little messages through dreams, because you know, there may be moments of clarity where the you know, the mind is something that's we've been wanting to come to some understanding, and sometimes in a dream the super soul can give us some, you know, understanding. The dream. But a lot of it gets mixed up. Yeah.
So I think what Mother is saying is maybe the dreams are not that the soul is moving, but they're just experiencing the past experience.
Well,
that's what Mother is trying to say,
that
the soul is not.
No. Someone's got to perceive it.
It's just rather than a
yeah.
Past experience, it's different parts of dreams as well.
Yeah.
You know, but not all dreams, but it can be.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a fact. There are various types of dreams.
There's different types of dreams as
yeah.
Well. So you can be dreaming. Also have precognition dreams.
Premonitions.
Yes. That are going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
It's much of the absolute platform, the future, present, past, and not different from our perspective. They are. But so somehow or other, when you have precognition dreams, you're actually outside of that limitation of present, past.
Maybe a dream that
and so you're tapping, so you can actually see things in the future sometimes. It depends what dream you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a good point. And the, you know, on that main point that we're talking about, the, you know, the soul, you know, sometimes they mechanically keep the hearts going, don't they? You know, which means that they're literally keeping it going as like a machine, and then they will put it into someone's chest, and then the soul will actually, you know, then the soul will actually keep it going. So it's, you know, sometimes they keep a body sort of running when the soul's literally left. You know, there's sort of, it's almost like just, you know, they're pumping air into it, and, you know, it's sort of like going like a machine, but, you know, it's dead. The soul is actually gone. So anyway, the point being made here is that, you know, it's an interesting topic, but the soul is carried by the subtle body. But liberation, which is what's called muktalinga, means that the soul not only becomes liberated from the gross physical body, but also from the subtle body. This is yes. Therefore, you know, what you were saying, Joe Pradarada, that many dreams, which may be various impressions that are there connected to the subtle body, which come out as dreams, would not affect someone who's a liberated person, even from the subtle body. You know, those impressions from past lives, are actually, which are there within the subtle body, are not going to affect that person like that. So therefore, you know, there it would be interesting to understand what they're dreaming about.
So I don't know if this is off topic, but did you hear about the devotee from Vrindavan in Christchurch who was worshipping on the altar, and that night had a dream that
All right, so very nice. So on the pretext, sometimes in the scriptures, it's, you know, devotees' dreams are they're not quite dreams, and therefore in the scriptures they say on the pretext of a dream, you know, Gaunatai appeared before the devotee while they were sleeping. So it's like on the pretext of a dream, but actually the Lord's actually appearing. So in that case, yeah. All right, as the symptoms of his liberation were manifest, he saw a very beautiful airplane coming down from the sky as if the brilliant full moon were coming down, illuminating all the 10 directions. Dhruva saw two very beautiful associates of Lord Vishnu in the plane. They had four hands, a blackish bodily luster, they were very youthful, and their eyes were just like reddish lotus flowers. They had clubs in their hands, and were dressed in very attractive garments with helmets and were decorated with necklaces, bracelets, and earrings.
Hare Krishna.
We're just at the point where we're describing how Dhruva Maharaj has become liberated through his yoga practice, and the two associates of the Lord have come down to see him, and they've got four-handed form, very beautiful. Dhruva Maharaj, seeing that these uncommon personalities were direct servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, immediately stood up. But, being puzzled, in hastiness, he forgot how to receive them in the proper way. Therefore, he simply offered obeisances with folded hands and chanted and glorified the holy names of the Lord.
This is interesting.
Chanting the holy names of the Lord is perfect in every way. So when he saw these Vishnu Dutas, he was puzzled. But he simply chanted the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, the Hare Krishna mantra. And he could satisfy these uncommon guests who had all of a sudden arrived before him. A devotee, therefore, either in danger or in happiness, constantly chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So, chanting Hare Krishna is absolute. Now, Dhruva, so verse 22, Dhruva was always absorbed in thinking of the lotus feet of the Lord, Krishna. His heart was full with Krishna. So, and you know, in the Sanskrit, you know, the word Krishna, Tam Krishna Pada Vinivishta, he's thinking of Krishna. When the two confidential servants of the Supreme Lord, so, you know, you asked the question before about, you know, Lord Krishna appearing at a certain time, is that in concrete? So here, you know, he is always thinking of Krishna. You know, so Krishna is, when you're hearing about him, chanting about him, thinking about him, he is non-different. So, you know, here in Satya Yuga, you know, Krishna is being meditated upon by Dhruva Maharaj. You know, and the very word Krishna is there in the Sanskrit. In this verse, the word Pushkaranaba Sammato is significant. Krishna, or Lord Vishnu, is known for his lotus eyes, lotus navel, lotus feet, and lotus palms.
move on. So, Prabhupada makes a point here. Anyone who very seriously engages in devotional service, bhakti yoga, can obtain in due course of time the same perfection of the human form of life as Dhruva did. In verse 23, he describes these Vishnu Dutas, Nanda and Sananda, the two confidential associates of Lord Vishnu, said, "Dear King, let there be all good fortune unto you. Please attentively hear what we shall say. When you were only 5 years old, you underwent severe austerities and you thereby greatly satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And in Prabhupada's purport, he says the same thing. What was possible for Dhruva is possible for anyone. Any five-year-old child can be trained within a very short time. His life will become successful by realization of Krishna consciousness. So verse 24. "We are representatives of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the creator of the whole universe, who carries in his hand the bow named Salanga. We have been specifically deputed to take you back to the spiritual world." To achieve Vishnu Loka is very difficult, but by your austerity you have conquered. Even the great rishis and demigods cannot achieve this position. Simply to see the supreme abode, the Vishnu planet, the sun and moon and all other planets, stars, lunar mansions and solar systems are circumambulating it. Now please come, you are welcome to go there. "Dear King Dhruva, neither your forefathers nor anyone else before you ever achieved such a transcendental planet. The planet known as Vishnu Loka, where Lord Vishnu personally resides, is the highest of all. It is worshipable by the inhabitants of all other planets within this universe. Please come with us and live there eternally." So, Prabhupada mentions in his purport, the associates of Lord Vishnu reminded him that not only his forefathers, but everyone else before him was unable to attain Vishnu Loka, the planet where Lord Vishnu resides. This is because everyone within this material world is either a Kami, Jnani or a Yogi, but there are hardly any pure devotees. And the transcendental planet, known as Vishnu Loka, is especially meant for devotees, not for Kamis, Jnanis or Yogis. Great rishis or demigods can hardly approach Brahma Loka. And it's stated in Bhagavad Gita, Brahma Loka is not a permanent residence. Yeah. Yes. So what is that verse?
This is the same book. It says your forefathers have not achieved.
Now I'm saying, is there a verse where it's fine, but it went back to God?
I think it was when Prabhupada was in
He may not have gone back to Godhead at this point. He's still, Swayambhuva Manu is still present, right? I mean, he's still the Manu.
No, he's Vaivaswata Manu.
What's that?
This Manu is Vaivaswata
Manu. No, I'm saying in this story, at the time of Dhruva Maharaj, Swayambhuva Manu is still living.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Still ruling.
And Dhruva Maharaj is after Kandu
Manu. When Swayambhuva Manu comes to meet Dhruva Maharaj, because his, I don't know, so you mean he's still on earth? He's still in the material world? Swayambhuva Manu comes to meet Dhruva Maharaj to give him advice, stop fighting.
Parishmati, that's where he is.
Parishmati.
Parishmati, that's where he's living. Assuming he's living in the same place.
You're saying that Swayambhuva Manu is living in Parishmati?
That's what it says in the
third canto.
So if it's, so if that was before Dhruva Maharaj, then I assume he's living in the same place.
Yes, I mean, I don't think there was a change of Manus during this pastime. I mean, you know, there'd be a partial devastation, you know, in between, in the pastime. But there's, you know, that's a big thing, the change of Manus. I don't think there's been a change of Manus. I think, as far as I can see, Swayambhuva Manu is still living. If you say he's in Parishmati, that's, then he's still there, you know, he's come to, but so therefore it appears that Dhruva Maharaj is going to attain Vishnuloka, go back to Godhead before him. So, you know, when it says Swayambhuva Manu in the third canto went back to Godhead, you know, eventually, you know, after Dhruva.
One other point is again about that time, future, present, not necessarily chronicle order, the kings need to have Vishnu codes to be
But still, it appears that Swayambhuva Manu is still present.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big thing. If there was a change in Manus, that would be mentioned in this story. You know, it's not a little incident.
Yes.
You know, it was saying the next millennium, you know, Dhruva meditated and then, you know. But it's the same. So, Prabhupada does discuss here, by mechanical processes, we are unable to reach the topmost planet of this universe, but the process called Bhakti Yoga, as executed by Maharaj Dhruva, can give one the facility not only to reach other planets within this universe, but also to reach beyond this universe to the Vishnu Loka planets. We have outlined this in our small booklet, Easy Journey to Other Planets. So that's a very nice book, Easy Journey to Other Planets, about how you can travel from one planet to another, and by Bhakti Yoga, even go beyond the material planets to the spiritual planets. Yeah, speaking about dreams, I gave that book to my nephew to read a couple of years ago. He said he's been having these amazing, you know, his dream life has been something quite psychedelic ever since I gave him that book. You know, it just sort of sparked a whole different level of mental activity. Easy Journey to Other Planets. So then he says, O immortal one, this unique airplane has been sent by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is worshipped by selected prayers, and who is the chief of all living entities. You are quite worthy to board such a plane. Prabhupada mentions in the purport here, according to astronomical calculation, along with the pole star, there is another star which is called Sushumna, where Lord Vishnu who is in charge of the maintenance of this material world, resides. Sisamara or Dhruvaloka, so those two planets, can never be reached by anyone but the Vaishnavas, the devotees. The associates of Lord Vishnu brought the special airplane for Dhruva and then informed him that the Lord Vishnu had especially sent this airplane. So then Maitreya, who's the great devotee who's narrating this story, he continues on to say that Dhruva, who is very dear to the Supreme Lord, when he heard the sweet speeches of the Lord's chief associates in the Vaikuntha planet, immediately took his sacred bath, dressed himself with suitable ornaments, and performed his daily spiritual duties. Thereafter, he offered his respectful obeisances to the great sages present there and accepted their blessings. Nice comment here by Prabhupada. How dutiful Dhruva Maharaj was in his devotional service. Even at the time he left this material world, he was constantly alert in the performance of his devotional duties. Every devotee should take his bath early in the morning and decorate his body with tilak. Now, at that time, because Dhruva Maharaj was living in Bhadarikashram, we've said there were great devotees there like Vyas and Naranarayana Rishi, great yogis from all over the universe. He did not become puffed up because the airplane sent by Lord Vishnu was waiting for him. As a humble Vaishnava, he accepted blessings from all the sages before riding on the plane brought by the chief of the Vaikuntha associates. Such a nice example.
When they say airplane,
Boeing 747. No, it's a... Jet Sky.
Garuda.
Garuda Airlines.
Yeah, is that what they're saying?
No, no, it's not that. These aeroplanes are generally made from flowers.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I understand
yeah.
That, but
yeah. And they fly by mantra, you know, or just the will, you know. So, and they're sort of like. It's sort of like palaces, you know. Yeah, there's when you're on them, there's all, you know, it's like a beautiful palatial setting. They have lakes and, you know, birds and, you know. So they're not. What's that? They're, you know, they're different varieties. Like, you know, you got your Mini Ma and your Mercedes. But, you know, if you're Dhruva, I'm sure you send the Mercedes.
I don't know how many people
say that. Yeah, but. You know, they are these aeroplanes are coming not from any material planet. They're sent from the Vishnu Loka or the spiritual planets, which are transcendental to the material planets. They're eternal planets. Sometimes those Vaikuntha or transcendental planets, Vishnu Loka planets. One of them can't... Always there's one of those planets within the universe where the Lord actually, when he comes to the material universe, he resides. But when the whole universe is ultimately destroyed, that spiritual planet remains. It really has no material effect on it. You know. So it's sort of transcendentally situated there, but it's not part of the material. So that spiritual aeroplane come from that spiritual planet, yeah. So it's, you know, very unique. Mm. So, you know, it's everything in the spiritual world is personal. It's not like you know, beam me up, Scotty, and, you know, that, you know, you sort of, all your atoms are, you know, compressed or something, and, you know, transported and put back together. Everything in the spiritual world is done in a very personal way. In other words, if you're going back to the spiritual world, you know, you're not sort of plucked out of oblivion and then just sort of dropped down somewhere. It's like, ooh, you know, where am I? And, you know, who are you? You know, everything is nicely done. You know, you're introduced to the people who will take you to the spiritual world, and, you know, everything is just a beautiful personal experience like that, you know, with the variety, all the paraphernalia, you know, and everything. Yeah. So this is an example of how, you know, it gives us a little bit of a taste. In the spiritual realm, because there's no impediments, then anything that you would like to do can just be done. So they, you know, everything is just joyfully done. For here, if you need to transport, you know, someone or ourselves from one place to another, everything is a lot of work and a lot of difficulty. But in the spiritual world, there's no obstructions to anything that needs to be done, and therefore everything is done with unlimited paraphernalia and in a very personal way. So, more description here. But, you know, this is such a beautiful description of Dhruva Maharaj. So, he's residing here. So, you know, as, you know, some of our yogis in class, you know, if you go to a great place in this world where, you know, it's full of yogis, you know, great exalted yogis, and if you ever have that great fortune and you associate with them and you live with them, you know, it could make a person somewhat proud that, yes, you know, I am sort of, you know, been living with this great yogi and that great yogi like that. Here Dhruva Maharaj, even this spiritual aeroplane came from Vishnu Loka. He took the blessings, you know, of everyone. Not that you know, he didn't think that, you know, now I've been blessed by God, that I'm, you know, now I'm exalted and I'm a, you're not going back to God yet. I'm going back to God, you know, like that. You know, I'm better than you. Just very, very humble, you know, beautiful qualities there. Not puffed up at all. So then before getting aboard, Dhruva Maharaj worshipped the airplane. He circumambulated the airplane. And also offered obeisances to the associates of Vishnu. In the meantime, he became as brilliant and illuminating as molten gold. He was thus completely prepared to board the transcendental plane. When Dhruva Maharaj was attempting to get on the transcendental plane, he saw death personified approach him. Not caring for death, however, he took advantage of the opportunity to put his feet on the head of death, and thus he got up on the airplane, which was as big as a house. Or a palace. So here, of course, we see that when a devotee leaves this world to go back to the spiritual world, it is different from someone who is not related to the Lord in devotional service, who, you know, becomes the victim of death personified. Prabhupada gives this nice analogy in the purport. You know, how one may see that, you know, a great devotee leaves this world and appears to die, become subject to death, and an ordinary person appears to be subject to death, and therefore, for an ordinary mundane vision, there appears to be no benefit. So one may say, what's the use of practicing all your yoga and being devoted to the Lord, because, you know, you'll end up dying and he'll end up dying. The person who doesn't do any yoga and doesn't devote themselves to the Lord, they both die, so what is the value? The difference is this, is that the example is given that death can be compared to the jaws of the cat, and the cat carries its kittens and transports the kittens from one place to another in a very loving way, whereas the same jaws for the rat become, you know, a place of suffering and torture. So they are, you know, the kitten feels very comfortable, so just a dhruva. In the presence of death, he could actually take advantage of it, in the same way that in the jaws of the cat's mouth, the kitten takes advantage of it. Whereas the rat cannot take an advantage, he just suffers. Death, Krishna is death, but for a non-devotee, they experience God only as death. But for a devotee, they experience God in his full manifestation. And death is just a small aspect of God's, you know, manifestations, which are all meant for the devotee's pleasure. But it's the same Lord and the same death. Now, at that time, drums and kettle drums resounded from the sky. The chief Gandharvas began to sing. So in the heavenly planets there are Gandharvas, and they sing. They're beautiful angelic singers. So, other demigods showered flowers like torrents of rain upon Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva was seated in the transcendental airplane, which was just about to start, when he remembered his poor mother, Suniti. He thought to himself, how shall I go alone to the Vaikuntha planet and leave behind my poor mother? So, the great associates of Vaikuntha Loka, Nanda and Sananda, could understand the mind of Dhruva Maharaj, and thus they showed him that his mother was going forward in another plane. Now, here, there's a nice story Prabhupada mentions in his purport. Prabhupada refers to his mother as Partha Pradarsika Guru. Partha Pradarsika Guru. That's the guru who shows you the way to Krishna, how to go back to the spiritual world. They may not necessarily train you like a shiksha guru, give you instruction and training. They may not necessarily, they don't initiate you and like that and become the central guru figure. But they show you, and they may not always be perfectly following, but they show you the path, and therefore they're, you know, special persons in your life who, you know, point the right direction which you eventually take up. They're called a Pata Padasika Guru, so there's three types of gurus. One who shows you the way in the right direction. Shiksha Guru, one who trains and instructs you in a practical way. And Diksha Guru, that person who initiates you, generally the, you know, central, you know, guru figure. So, now, Prabhupada said in the next purport, in verse 33, this incident proves that the Shiksha or Diksha Guru, who has a disciple who strongly executes devotional service, like Dhruva Maharaj, can be carried by the disciple, even though the instructor is not as advanced. So, a guru takes a disciple who becomes very, very advanced, even beyond what the guru is. And that disciple can then take that, deliver the guru, or carry the guru. So, although Suniti was an instructor to Dhruva Maharaj, she could not go to the forest because she was a woman, nor could she execute austerities and penances as Dhruva Maharaj did. Still, Dhruva was able to take his mother with him. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaj also delivered his atheistic father, Hiranyakasipu. The conclusion is that a disciple or an offspring who is a very strong devotee can carry with him to Vaikuntha Loka either his father, mother, or Shiksha or Diksha Guru. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati the Kaur used to say, if I could perfectly deliver one soul back home, back to Godhead, I would think my mission propagating Krishna consciousness to be successful. Prabhupada goes on to say, the Krishna consciousness movement is spreading now all over the world, and sometimes I think that even though I am crippled in many ways, if one of my disciples becomes as strong as Dhruva Maharaj, then he will be able to carry me with him to Vaikuntha Loka. Any comments on that? So while Dhruva Maharaj was passing through space, he gradually saw all the planets of the solar system. And on the path, he saw all the demigods in the airplanes showering flowers upon him. So we see here that one who becomes a devotee of the Lord, you know, perfectly, everything becomes known to them. They know everything. So, if one knows the planet of the Supreme Lord, one knows all other planets on the path to Vaikuntha. We should remember that Dhruva Maharaj's body was different from ours. While boarding the Vaikuntha airplane, his body changed to a completely spiritual golden hue. No one can surpass the higher planets in a material body. But when one gets a spiritual body, he can travel not only to the higher planetary systems of this material world, but even to the still higher planetary systems known as Vaikuntha Loka. It should be noted also that while Suniti was going to Vaikuntha Loka, she also changed her body into a spiritual form. Yes, yeah. That's right. If Dhruva Maharaj's desires were fulfilled, you know, materially and spiritually.
In the sense that as soon as he desired his mother to go,
the arrangements were made, and he also got to see all the planets.
Mm. Mm.
So, Dhruva surpassed the seven planetary systems of the great sages, known as the Saptarishi. Beyond that region, he achieved the transcendental situation of permanent life in the planet where Lord Vishnu lives. So the Sananda and Nanda, they're described here as spiritual astronauts. It says that only such spiritual astronauts can pilot their airplane beyond the seven planets and arrive in the region of eternal blissful life. Vaikuntha Loka. So, spiritual astronauts. So, the self-effulgent Vaikuntha planets, by whose illumination alone all the illuminating planets within this material world give off reflected light, cannot be reached by those who are not merciful to other living entities. Only persons who constantly engage in welfare activities for other living entities can reach the Vaikuntha planets. Yes. Yes. The welfare activities discussed here means that you're actually helping a person to be free from the cycle of birth and death. You know, there are welfare activities, for instance, sometimes people may go to a prison and they may, you know, distribute some foodstuffs or something for the prisoners. They may help give them counselling, or, you know, different things which are, you know, sort of, they try to ease their suffering, whatever they can. But the ultimate welfare work for the prisoners would be to help them to actually reform and to leave prison and not go back. And so, you know, that type of welfare activity is what is referred to here, that you, you know, help a person to become liberated from the concept that I am this body, thus liberated from the cycle of birth and death, and help them to, you know, realize their own spiritual nature, their eternal relationship with the Supreme Soul, Krishna, and how to go. Yeah, there's a that merciful nature must be manifest. You know, if someone is envious of, see, the nature, the mood of the Supreme Lord himself is that he is always trying to reclaim the fallen conditioned souls from material existence back to the reality, eternal spiritual abode. So, one who is one with God in their consciousness, their thoughts, they have the same mood that, you know, Krishna or, you know, his form is Vishnu, wants to help other living entities come back to the spiritual world. So, you know, I also have that same mood. If one is envious of other living entities, then their mood is, they can't claim to be a devotee of the Lord. They can't claim to be in one in their consciousness, you know, with the same, you know, understanding. Therefore, you know, they have no real claim to be a devotee or to, you know, therefore go back to the spiritual world. No, they can't be. If they're envious, they can't be a devotee. That's the point. Yeah.
Because devotee knows that. Mm. Every devotee I've come across is a bit envious and not a devotee.
Well, that's a different topic, but envious. Okay. Envious is devotee. That's actually a question
after
that
stage.
Yes, this is envious of ordinary entities.
We'll discuss that. It's a good point, but we don't have time. We'll just finish these last couple of verses. Persons who are peaceful, equipoised, cleansed and purified, who know the art of pleasing other living entities, keep friendship only with devotees of the Lord, they alone can very easily achieve the perfection of going back home, back to Godhead. In this way, the fully Krishna conscious Dhruva Maharaj, the exalted son of Maharaj Uttanapada, attained the summit of the three statuses of planetary systems. Now, Maitreya, who's telling this story, says to Vidura that as a herd of bulls circumambulates a central pole on their right side, all the luminaries within the universal sky, so all the planets and luminaries, unceasingly circumambulate the abode of Dhruva Maharaj with great force and speed. So literally this pole star, where actually it is, it has all the qualities of a Vaikuntha or transcendental planet, where Dhruva Maharaj resides with the Lord, all the planets within the universe circumambulate that pole star, which is known as Dhruva Loka. So if you ever go to the northern hemisphere and you look up into the sky and you see the pole star, you know that that's where Dhruva Maharaj lives. Can you see it?
Actually,
yes, you see the pole star.
Well, some people actually, because you would see seven stars like that.
That's the Saptarishis, yeah.
No, that used to happen in India, but I'm not sure if that is the actual pole star. It's just bulbous stuff.
Some of them. Can you actually see the pole star? Like, is it, I don't think you see it, but you can see where the Saptarishi stars are. You can see that. You can't see the pole star. Yeah. What's that? You do? What's the pole star? They call it the pole star. We just know who lives there. What is it called? North Star. North Star, because you go to the northern hemisphere, you look up, and it's the central point which the whole zodiac pivots. I have to look into that. So maybe someone can find out. Can you actually see the pole star? You know, you look and get your colour. You want to draw it? Yeah. Has anyone got it?
You've
got to find out. No, it's within this universe. This pole star is actually within this universe, but it says that it has, just like we got. Yeah, Vaikuntha is the top of the universe. That is, and then you have below that the higher planetary systems. You have the pole star, and then you're just above the earthly planetary system. Just below Mahaloka is the pole star. Yeah, I'd like to find out. He's gone off to get his something. He's a protractor. Alright. After observing the glories of Dhruva, the great sage Narada, playing his veena, went to the sacrificial arenas of the Prachetas and very happily chanted the following verses. So, Narada, of course, was the spiritual master of Dhruva, who gave him instruction. You didn't find it? No? What about a bit of paper? Draw a bit of... You got a bit of paper and a pen. So, Narada chanted these verses. Simply by the influence of his spiritual advancement and powerful austerity, Dhruva Maharaj, the son of Suniti, who was devoted to her husband, acquired an exalted position not possible to attain even for the so-called Vedantist or strict followers of the Vedic principles, not to speak of ordinary human beings. So, this is a nice verse. It's saying that, you know, there are many scholars of religious scriptures. So here's describing Vedanta scriptures. But if someone actually goes back to the spiritual world, that person is special amongst all those great scholars. You know, so you can have all the pundits and they can discuss the, you know, the linguistics and, you know, the semantics of, you know, the various scriptural writings, you know, in and out, and they can, you know, argue all the, you know, points back and forth. But amongst them, one who actually goes back to the spiritual world is celebrated as someone, you know, significantly exalted. There is a difference. There is a difference. And Dhruva, you know, so, and it is those persons, that's why we read the Srimad Bhagavatam, because we actually hear what Dhruva, what his mood, his words, his what he said to the Supreme Lord, what the Supreme Lord said to him, that is particularly prominent. So there are many discussions you can hear about religious or spiritual things, but when you hear from someone who actually attained that perfect goal, that is significantly worth hearing. Especially the fact that he took his mother. So we want to hear from his mother as well. But we actually do in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because she gave some instructions here. That's why the Srimad Bhagavatam is so exalted, you know, because it singles out, there are, you know, all of the devotees, anyone who is trying to understand religious or spiritual topics, they're all exalted, you know, persons, if they're proper, if they're sincere, you know, they're not just making a show of it. But amongst them, you know, when you get someone who actually achieves the result of, you know, being transferred to the spiritual world, you know, speaking personally with the Supreme Lord, we want to hear, you know, and we want to see their character, their behaviour and their discussions. And that's here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's therefore Narada's singing, you know, this is really glorious, it's something special. Yeah. Look, they've got some goodness in them and they may still be in some ignorance as to, you know, a better way to help or the best way. So, you know, there's good, there's better and there's best. Here, if we can help someone achieve what Dhruva Maharaj achieved, you solve all their problems eternally. If you... other welfare activities can temporarily, even just for a short period in someone's life, help them but it cannot help them even in their next life or the many lives that come after that. So, you know, a permanent welfare solution is required. You know, just like you have, you know, the governments have problems with people who take drugs. So they have their temporary solutions. All right, we will give them methadone, and we will have little clinics where they can come and take their drugs. They sort of, there's some welfare program. But if they actually come and chant Hare Krishna and eat prasadam, as we see, they'll actually stop taking drugs altogether because it works. You know. If they follow it. So, you know, there's a more permanent solution. Not only does it help them in this lifetime, but if they actually be, you know, then develop their, if they can think of the Supreme Lord, they can transfer themselves to, you know, the spiritual planet. So there's an eternal benefit. Mm. No, I don't think it's a Gyata Sukriti. I mean, she, you know, she willingly directed him to worship the Supreme Lord.
Was she aware that he had the potential to actually...
She wasn't aware that, no, he could actually go back to Godhead and take her with... Yeah, she was not fully aware, but... She, it's not necessarily Gyata Sukriti in that sense, because she was aware that she was directing him. She, I mean, she wasn't trying to be some guru, she was just being his mother.
It was not a desperation, like, you know, how you say, oh, I don't know God, which kind of thing. It was not like that. Was it a conscious kind of a direction? Like, she knew that the Supreme Lord had answered.
Yes, she had some understanding.
Because she said, even your grandfather had achieved so many things from the Lord.
She had some understanding. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. Nice to have you here. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. We're doing a whole different story next week from the very beginning. So it's a good show.
This is in the northern hemisphere. Like this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is the Saptarishi. And when you look down, like this is
Tall Star.
I'm not sure. I don't think this is true, but this is what they show.
That's what they say. I see. I've got an astronomy book at home. I'll have a look and see if you can actually see the pole star. All right. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much. Lovely to meet you.
That's good. Hare Krishna.
Yeah, I'd like to come again.
Yeah, it's good. You can fill her in on some of the discussions we had about dreams. We spent about 20 minutes. Hare Krishna, certainly. All right then. Now we've pretty much finished, but
yeah.
say that again?
Through my sentence, yeah. The next chapter.
That'll be the next chapter. So, while we're on that, next week we start chapter 13. No, not next week, but next class, which is a class session.
There's no next
week? What's happening next week? Nothing. We've all become Mayavadis. We've all become Buddhists. We've attained Nirvana. There's no next week. Next week has been cancelled. Right?
No, I mean, they'll be glad to. There's no other event on next week.
Let me see my diary. What have we got? What actually happens next week? I'm sure, you know, next week has a meaning. Okay. Oh, yes, I've got, there is a next week, it's in my diary. Saturday the 27th. We can meet, when is Balaram's appearance day?
The 21st of August.
Of August, okay. So we got a, you know, a fair way, yeah. Alright, so yeah, we got... I think we need to do perhaps a little bit of catch up. Having finished this unit, we're sort of due to have an exam. So, so I won't. We can probably turn this off now. But is anyone in control of this? Yeah. Oh. Turn it off. Is there? Finish.
Well, if we have the revision, it's better to have it on the day of the exam.
That's right.
Because it's sort of fresh, and
yes, that's true.
You know, we can't do anything else with that half of the. So.
Revision for how many hours, brother? Couple of hours?
For those who don't want a revision, they can just come back.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's say in 2 weeks from now we do the exam. That gives people, you know, everyone plenty of time to study all the homework questions, to listen to the lectures. Most of it we've actually covered, you know, somewhere during the talk, usually on following it through, and I'm actually discussing, those very points. Yeah, very few that I actually have literally read out, pretty much what was related to those questions. So, it's there in the lectures, and, you know, we'll also have the revision. So, if you read something, you think, I'm pretty sure this is the answer to that, but, you know, not quite sure, then that's what the revision is for, that you can say, you know, this one here, is it, you know, this is the proper understanding of that, if you're not sure, we can discuss it. So, you know, 2 weeks gives you time to go over them, and also to then do the revision. So, I think what we'll do next week is we'll begin the next chapter 13. All right. but we will spend a little bit of the last part of the session, about an hour, just catching up on, you know, where people may be a little bit behind, or you know, we can do an activity, you know, some